won't be long though where most of the parents won't really be seeing as much of their children as they have up to now, at least during the weekdays, because holidays are nearly over, school term starts. I wonder how many of you children here looking forward to going back to school. Children looking forward to going back to school, put your hand up. Got one, two, and Michael. Must admit, when I was a kid, I never ever looked forward to going back to school after the holidays. Well, you know, I never looked forward to going to school any day, but never mind. I've been reading a book recently, and it talks about what education was like in the day of Jesus. And I thought it was so interesting, I wanted to share it with you. And it seems, you know, that those kids had a lot harder at school than what you kids do. That may surprise you, but it seems that they did. In those days, children began their education when they were three on their mother's knee, because the mother was commissioned to teach them a very special skill, a very special ability that would help them when they came to be educated. I wonder if you can guess what that ability was. Anybody? Guess what type of thing mum had to teach them. Any idea? Do you know what it was? It was the ability to memorise. So what mum would do, she'd tell them the stories from the history of the Jewish people, stories you learn in Sunday school, like David, Goliath, those type of stories. But then she would expect them, even at the age of three, to repeat those stories back with the exact detail that she told them the stories. So they learnt to memorise. The parents also had to teach the children Hebrew, the Hebrew language. Normally they would speak in Greek or Aramaic, but they had to teach them the Hebrew language to learn how to read the Hebrew. Never worried too much about writing it, but to learn how to read the Hebrew. And especially the boys. Because you see, when they went to school, the one thing they had to learn was how to read the Bible, their Bible, the sacred scriptures, which were written, of course, in Hebrew. See, the Jewish people strongly and rightly believed that God had spoken to their leader Moses, and that he had given to Moses a copy of what he had said. And Moses had written it down. If we can have this up. And he'd written it down in those first five books of the Bible. They called it the Torah. Now, I wonder you children here, some of you children, tell me what are the first five books of the Bible. Who's going to tell me? I was hoping my grandson would be here because he would tell me. He's gone. Who's going to tell me? Yes? Genesis? Exodus? Very good. They were the first five books. They called them the Torah because they are instruction. That's what the word means, instructions. It also means way. And it showed them the way that they could please God. You know, every Jewish parent knew that the best thing in the whole world their child could ever learn was the Torah. There was nothing better that they could ever learn than that, especially if they were a boy. The way of living that could please God. And you know, the greatest ambition that a Jewish parent had for their child was that they would grow up to become first a disciple of a well-known rabbi, and then, if God so blessed, that they would become a rabbi themselves. So, at the age of six, the children, every day, except for the Sabbath, would front up to the synagogue. And there they would be taught by the priest or a scribe or a visiting rabbi the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. You know the book they begin with? Not Genesis, Leviticus. I find Leviticus one of the hardest books in the Bible. That's where these six-year-olds would start. They would learn Leviticus because that book showed them how they needed to be pure in God's sight and through the sacrifices, how they could be pure in God's sight. One of the things the teachers would do in their school was this. He would sometimes come into class with some honey, and he'd take the little children and he'd put honey on their fingertips. And then he'd tell them to suck that honey. And he would say, even as the honey is sweet to your taste buds, the Torah, God's instructions for living, are sweeter than that for your soul. Yearn for the Torah, the knowledge of it, as you would yearn for honey, for its sweetness. Well, by the time a child had reached the age of 10, they would have memorized. Do you know what does memorize mean? Learn by heart. Yeah, thanks. Good old Jake at the back that was going to help me out there. It's good. To learn everything completely by heart. By the age of 10, they had memorized the book of Genesis, the book of Exodus, the book of Leviticus, the book of Numbers, and the book of Deuteronomy. And they understood what every story meant. Can you imagine that? You learn memory verses. I remember being at a conference one where a young girl of 13 got up and she recited from memory the whole of Romans chapter 12. And I was impressed because I can only do verses 1 and 2. These children could get up at the age of 10 and recite, beginning at Genesis, all of those books. How about that? Now you notice the numbers beside it. That's the number of chapters that we have in each of those books. Anybody add them up? How many chapters is that? Who's quick? 187 chapters that they would know by the time they were 10. Now, at the age of 10, the first separation took place. Up to then, they'd been going to the synagogue every day except the Sabbath to learn. When they were 10, they had a bit of a test. And only the best students carried on their education. Those students who were seen as having the natural ability to understand and retain knowledge were chosen to continue their education. Any girls who'd been taught by this time, they dropped off completely. But only those who had the very best ability were allowed to continue. They went to a place called the House of Learning, which was a special building built next to the synagogue. The rest, they were told they hadn't quite good enough to continue. And they were sent home into their families to learn the family trade. So if their dad was a carpenter, they learned to be a carpenter. If he was a builder, learned to be a builder. He was a wine grower, and so on, a farmer, whatever it was. But the others, they continued their education. By the time they were 14 or 15, they would have memorized the whole of the Old Testament. Genesis through to Malachi. How many books is that? See, you don't even know how many books in it. 39 books of the Old Testament they would know off by heart. And they would understand all the prophecies, all the Psalms, the book of Job, all those things. They would know. You could come to them and say, could you just recite for me Isaiah? No problem. Start at verse 1 and go right through. They also were taught at that time the art of asking questions. See, over the years, all the great scholars of the time through the centuries, they had studied the Bible too, the Old Testament. And they had asked questions about different passages of Scripture, different verses, although they didn't call them verses then, different doctrines. And these old scholars, these rabbis, had come up with questions and with answers. Some of these have been written down. A lot have just been memorized over the years. These children were expected to know all that stuff too. They were expected to know who said what about this particular verse and why they said it. Who said this? Who said that? Why were they saying it? Who were they talking to? They had to know all that information. Along with that, they were taught to respond to a question with a question. See, the Jewish way of education was different to ours. If we want to know how much someone knows, we ask them a direct question and they give us the information back, don't we? Those days it was different. If a rabbi asked you a question, he expected that you would know the information. He would want you to come back with another question that took the subject a lot further. That would show not only that you knew, but that you understood it and could take it further. Remember Jesus at the age of 12 in the temple? What was he doing? They were amazed because of the questions he asked the scribes. That was the way they were taught. So just imagine the standard of learning these young men had reached by the age of 15. But you know what? They still had a long way to go. At the age of 15, the very best were encouraged, only the very best, to seek out a well-known rabbi and apply to become one of his disciples. They just say to him, "I want to become one of your disciples." That meant more than just learning what that rabbi could teach him. The goal was to be like the rabbi. They were really saying, "I want to be like you. I want to have your wisdom. I want to teach people the way you teach people. I want to give you the example that you do. I want to show by my life like you do how to please God." And so they went to them and said, "I want to be your disciple. I want to impact the world as you do. To live the life that will show God's people how they should live." And the rabbi wouldn't say straight away, "Yeah, that's good." See, the rabbi would only want to train a youth who could become like him, who had the potential to become like him. He had no time to waste training the good intentioned who did not have what it would take. He would have more than one disciple, but he only wanted the very best. So when someone came up to him like that, he would closely interrogate them, perhaps for a week or 2 weeks, over how much they understood about the Old Testament as we know it. How many questions they could ask. What they knew about all the questions that had been asked through the ages. He perhaps would have them, as one of the days, recite the whole of the Old Testament through before him to see if they made any mistakes whatsoever. That's the type of perfection he was after. If he decided that this person wasn't up to it, he would say to them something like this: "You obviously love God and know the Torah, but you do not have what it takes to be my disciple. Go home and learn the family business." And that was the end of this young man's ambitions. He was not allowed to go and ask another rabbi. He'd been told, "That's it. You're not up to standard. Go home." But if the rabbi believed that this man had what was needed, he would say to him a very short phrase: "Come, follow me." And the student would do that. He would probably leave his parents, his synagogue, his village, and he would travel around with that rabbi, learning how to do what that rabbi did. He would go everywhere with him. He would live with him. He would give up his whole life just to be like this rabbi. And he would rejoice in the privilege that had been given to him. You know, it's hard for us to understand this. The young Jewish boys growing up around about 8, 9, 10 years of age would dream of being one day offered such a position. To be a disciple first and then to be a rabbi. You see, to be a rabbi in that society was honoured above all other positions. It was like a person who wanted to be an AFL footballer today, or a celebrity, or a film star of some sort. To be a rabbi was to be the greatest thing you could ever be. Sadly, most boys arrived at the age of 15 knowing that they would never make it. They were just not good enough to be part of such a select group. That's how it was till Jesus came along. Then along comes Jesus, around about the age of 30. He is immediately seen as a rabbi, which is surprising because they know he has not been through the education process that the disciples should have been through. He's a carpenter, but they know he's a rabbi. He shows it by his knowledge and his teaching and what he does. But as a rabbi, Matthew 4:18 tells us this. He was one day beside the Sea of Galilee, and he saw two brothers, Simon called Peter and his brother Andrew. They were casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come follow me, said Jesus, and I will make you fishers of men. Come follow me. So I said, I've been moved by what Rob Bell writes about this, and he says this: why are these men fishermen? Because they aren't disciples. They weren't good enough. They didn't make the cut. Jesus calls the not good enoughs to be his disciples. And once they left their nets and followed him. This is strange, isn't it? Why do they just drop their nets? Why would they quit their jobs for some rabbi they hardly know? But given the first century context, it's clear what is going on here. Can you imagine what this must have been like to have a rabbi say to you, come, follow me? Have a rabbi say to you, you can be like me? Of course you would drop your net. The rabbi believes you can do what he does. He thinks you can be like him. You know, here we find Jesus doing the totally unexpected. He doesn't call the A-graders, as Terry Scobe might say. But he calls those in society who were not considered by Jewish society as disciple material. He calls them to be his disciples. To, by the power of God at work in them, become like him in this world. Why? Jesus had faith in those men. He knew that they could achieve the task that had to be done in his name, because he, by the power of God the Spirit, would enable them. And they did. They changed the world upside down. You know, many of you are Christians here. Some are perhaps thinking about it, what it means to be a Christian. When Jesus first touched your heart with a call upon your life and said to you, come follow me, it was not because you are amazingly intelligent, although I'm sure many of you are, or because you are extraordinarily gifted, or because you are pure and unsullied by sin or the world. It was because he loves you and knows that he can make you like himself in this world. And he can impact the world around you through you in some way or other. Isn't that amazing? I was thinking about this talk last Wednesday when I read the word for today, for the day, and you probably read it. It featured the verse from 1 Corinthians 1:27. And it says, God chose the weak things to shame the strong. And then the commentary went on to say this: God can do much with very little. Look what he did for David with a sling and a stone. Watch him feed 5,000 with a boy's lunch, and he will do the same for you. Your life is like a pebble, a little rock. It may not look like much, but drop it into a pond and watch the ripples spread in every direction. And then it left us with this challenge. Well, I'll leave you with this with you today. Every day you and I live, we have three options in life. We can think only of ourselves and our own interests. How often do we do that? All we think about really is ourselves. Or, seeing we know that success doesn't come without the possibility of failure, and we don't really want to fail, we take no risks. We don't go outside our comfort zone. And we go no further. Second option. Third option. We can ask God to show us what he's put in us to use. The opportunities set before us each day. The people he's gathered around us. The ways that he's geared us up to impact the world. And then we can use our lives to make ripples that will touch other people to the glory of God. That's the privilege, isn't it, of being his disciple. Sometimes I think in the church we say to people, come and be the disciple of the Lord of Love. It's something that we can do to please him. Well, we do please him. But never forget that he has given us this awesome, awesome privilege. Us, you and me, of being his disciple. Let us make sure that we do that and use what we have been given to glorify his name.